Of all the genres of poetry that we hear and read, children's poetry may be the most misunderstood. When we think about children's poetry, rhymes like those of Mother Goose pop into mind. But there's more to it than simple moralistic nursery chants. Arnold Adolph is a Yellow Springs resident who writes and collects poetry aimed at a younger audience. He didn't start out writing just for children.
Well, I'll tell you the professional story of my life. I was born and raised as a nice middle-class Jewish American young male in the Bronx, New York City, the only borough with an article in front of its name. And I went to school in New York, and I went to the City University of New York and Columbia University. I'm a trained historian, having studied with Alan Nevins and Henry Steele Commager and Luchtenberg and David Donald and all those good guys that made that tuition worthwhile. But I'm also a renegade historian, in that I was a pioneer dropout from Columbia University Graduate School in 1958 and went down to the village, which I have to explain to my children here in Ohio doesn't mean the little town on the other side of the little Miami River, but is the Greenwich Village in New York City. And became a full-fledged poet and a teacher. And I taught in New York City, primarily in schools in Harlem and in the Upper West Side of Manhattan. They were not solidly black schools because of the nature of the geography of the city and the population patterns. And so the schools, even in the West Side of Harlem, would be a third black and a third Puerto Rican and other Hispanics and a third white and Oriental and those other mixtures that New York is so wonderful for. And I began collecting poetry for my students, and that's really how I began my career in children's literature. I began collecting poetry, and particularly black American poetry, Afro-American poetry, and I dipped into the long and ongoing tradition of black American writers of this century and before in an attempt to add to the tokenism of the textbooks. I'd be handed a book that would say modern American poetry, and there would be a token County Cullen poem or a token Gwendolyn Brooks poem or Claude McKay, perhaps, and that would be it. And I was very much involved with attempting to create an atmosphere of the whole truth in the classroom. And if one element, like a house of cards, one card is missing, the whole structure falls down. And that element was missing, and the element was a side-by-side examination of the variety of parallel cultures and literatures in America. So I began to collect material. I began to realize the vastness of what existed, the richness, the uniqueness of some of the work, and also the applying the same kinds of aesthetic and literary standards, how superb a body of work had been created, particularly in the 20th century, and how neglected so much of this work was in terms of mainstream America. And then my wife, who's a black woman, Virginia Hamilton, sold her first novel, the first manuscript back in 66, 67, called Zeely. And we had then a contact in a publishing house in New York. And a strange completion of the circle. One of the first people who gave Virginia a little bit of entree was a young woman named Janet Schulman, who was a graduate of Antioch College. And Virginia and Jan met in Antioch way back in the 1950s. And Janet now is editor in chief and vice president of Random House NAF Pantheon. She is one of the most important and influential women in the children's literature field in terms of the publishing system. But at that time, she was a copy editor, and she remembered a story that Virginia had done for Paul Treichler's modern drama class here. So I showed Jan and her editor these black poems. I was just looking for some free duplicating time on their machine, and they read the poetry, and they said, come in, let's talk, we think you have a book. So one thing led to another, and then after five or six anthologies, black anthologies and urban anthologies that were integrated and international, I began to present my own poetry which I'd been writing all along since puberty, I guess you could say, and began to publish my own poetry. So here I am today, 48 and a half years old, middle-aged, middle-class, heterosexual, male poet, anthologist. I've published 25 books. Half of them are anthologies, and half are my own poetry. And I kind of tread a thin line along a variety of boundaries, perhaps.
Has your poetry always been exclusively focused for a younger audience, or, say, for children?
No. My poetry, when I was young, was written for my peers. And I think most poets begin to write for themselves and for those in their same generation. And when I was in New York and living in the fringes of the beat world or the variations thereof, I was writing for people my age and for others. I was involved in the jazz world. At one time, I was a manager of Charles Mingus, a superb jazz bassist. But I had one of those moments of revelation here in Yellow Springs early on in the late 60s when my daughter was going to the Antioch School, and she came home one day after working with Bev Price and the great big fat phonics linguistics approach to the teaching of reading, Bloomfield and somebody out of the University of Michigan. And Bev would have the kids start with the teacher's edition, so they'd feel they were really into something heavy, and they'd be reading page 537, and she'd have a little egg timer and they'd spend a few minutes. And so Lee came home one day and saw that I was at my typewriter, and she said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm writing." And she said, "Well, what are you writing?" I'm doing this great experimental work for Poetry Magazine in Chicago and all of the latest trends of contemporary innovative work. You know, I'm playing with my art and sullen craft, as Dylan, Dylan Thomas, what did he say? Craft and sullen art. So Lee said, "Well, I'm learning to read." So I said, "Well, what are you reading?" She said, "I'm reading Ma Ba Fa Da Ra." She said, "What are you writing?" "I'm writing Ma Ba Fa Da La." And I was indeed taking the word mandala, which is a Hindu religious symbol, and attempting to break it apart and eliminate the semantic baggage that the words carry with them, as all words do. And so she and I were working not only in the same system of soundings and syllables, but really with the same intent. And I began to realize that I was working and writing for children, and my audience at that time and for much of my life would be a young audience. My first book was indeed called Ma Ndala. My first anthology, which is still doing very well, and it's only been 13 years or so, 1968 to 15 years, I guess, 1983. It's called I Am the Darker Brother. But my first book of poetry of my own writing is called Ma Ndala, Your Mother and Your Father and Singing, I guess if you could translate from English to English. And then a succession of books followed, and I've written for children primarily. I continue to write for adults, but do not publish books of poetry for adults. And I think that may be another step in the future, which will require a whole new image, I would say.
How is it different? I mean, what kind of shift did you have to make when you mentally decided, well, this is for children?
Well, it's very exciting. First of all, your material is going to go out to thousands and thousands of young people all over the country. And at a time of depressed economy and spiraling inflation, when a 32-page book or a 48-page book will sell for $10 or $12, you know that every title, every copy of every title in a library or a school will be used by hundreds and hundreds of young people and the teachers and reading specialists and librarians. So that's an exciting entree, far beyond the writing for a small coterie of academics or a small number of people playing with language or even attempting to influence each other semantically. That's an exciting element. There are limitations when you write for younger children in terms of semantic line of force, because there are some things that they haven't experienced or don't understand. But basically, as you write for older children, there isn't anything you can't do or say that you couldn't do or say for adults. And many times children bring certainly much more of an openness and perhaps even more sophistication to the poetry that you present to them. There are many elements in the field of children's literature and in the fields of writing poetry, particularly for children. Traditionally, it's been children's verse. Robert Louis Stevenson to Shel Silverstein today is traditional rhyme scheme verse. We begin language almost, let alone poetry, with Hickory Dickory Dock, The Mouse Ran Up the Clock. And in attempting to bring some elements of contemporary adult, quote-unquote, poetry that have come into use in the last 50 or 60 years, I want to stretch that line from Hickory Dickory Dock, The Mouse Ran Up the Clock, to Hickory Dickory Dock, The Mouse Ran Up the Wall, or The Old Gray Wall, or The Slippery Old Wall, and I use a variety of techniques that are not new, but many times are new and sometimes resisted in terms of poetry for children rather than verse for children. It's an exciting field, and it's wonderful to have 8 and 9 and 10 and 12 year old groupies write you fan mail all
do
over
they?
The country, and they do. Yes, wonderful.
Do you write on certain topics? I mean, are there certain themes that your poems
cover?
Well,
of course, because of my interracial marriage and my children who are black and white, I'm interested in that duality, in that combination of cultures, and beyond just black and white, to all cultures in a pluralistic, humanistic society. And so two of my most important books are called Black as Brown as Tan and All the Colors of the Race, which deal specifically with what it is to be an interracial young person in the world. But I also have a relatively new book called Birds Poems, which is a series of poems that I jokingly describe as having been dictated to me by this fat robin on my lawn one morning, telling me from the bird's point of view what it is to be a bird in that stinking environment of my noisy lawnmower and all of the other things that we contribute as we share the same patch of land. I am the running girl as a young female running track, which is a kind of a composite of my daughter and her sisters and brothers when they ran track in the 6th, 7th, 8th grade here in Yellow Springs. My big bestseller since 1979 and continuing very strongly is a book called Eats Poems, which has more to do with the inner man in terms of physicality than perhaps with raising consciousness beyond chocolate desserts and a variety of other kinds of things. It seems that I've hit a strain of universality that goes beyond race and class and everything else, and that has enabled me. Well, I'll read you the opening three poems that are interconnected, which express perhaps the depth of my philosophy.
Okay.
Eats are on my mind from early morning to late at night in spring or winter. There is no wrong or right time to feel that sudden need to find that sudden meal. I am always hungry. Not me, but cows walk up and beg to be burgers. Chicken legs will tap dance to my teeth, and oatmeal cookies have been known to fly out of their jars as I pass by. My mouth stays shut, but food just finds a way. My tongue says, we are full today, but teeth just grin and say, come in. I am always hungry. That's fun.
I was going to say, I think
that's a lot of fun.
Got a lot of universal appeal.
And I can say it's heartfelt as I pat my tummy or something like that. The most liberating part of writing for young people, the way I do it, it allows me every morning from 8 o'clock in the morning as I sit at my desk and work with yellow pads or with my typewriter, is to go outside of myself. And so not just to go outside of my age and my persona and my experience, but to go outside of my gender and my race the food poems aside, I am the running girl as a 12-year-old girl that could come from any kind of background, and the girl in all the colors of the race as a young interracial female of 12, and outside inside poems as a young boy of 9 or 10 who has to go up against these monster 12-year-old pitchers his first time in Little League, and of course even beyond the human form to the birds, and a variety of other kinds of things that I've done in 15 or so books. My new one that will be out next year is a fantasy series with the elements of repetition, rhyme, and let me see, what are the three R's? Rhyme, repetition, and reversal. And it's called The Cabbages Are Chasing the Rabbits. It's called The Cabbages Are Chasing the Rabbits. So there again, I go into animal or fantasy elements. It's a wonderful way to live.
I was just going to ask you, I'm trying to imagine how it would be if my work was to sit down at a table and place myself in another persona, whatever, or animus, whatever you want to call it. I mean, how do you do it? Do you just sit down and...
Well, it's self-exploitation of the gentlest sort. I don't smoke. We've given up cigarettes for about 8 years, but I still... I'm addicted to caffeine, and so I must go up with my coffee. But one of my little keys to that doorway, perhaps, is a tablespoon of peanut butter on a saucer that I lick very, very slowly and will go down and get another scoop of it. And I grind the peanut butter at the health food ninth house health food store down on Xenia Avenue, and I try to live a healthy life in general so I can move back and forth with ease, although if I gain too much weight, it's hard to squeeze through that doorway to another persona or into childhood. You exploit those elements of immaturity. You attempt to cultivate all of those parts of you that everyone is either embarrassed by or that they hope you would have left far behind years before, or that to shrivel up and blow away in the wind of making mortgage payments and raising children and being a husband and a father and wife and all of the multiple roles that artists deal with. It doesn't always work, and many times you'll read your newspaper and begin to write a poem that will have to do with Contra guerrillas in Nicaragua that morning, because there is nothing else that could possibly intercede if there's that kind of news, or an assassination, which happens all too frequently, whatever it may be. Poets should be part of their time and be free to move in and out of their time, but not to neglect their time, not just in the terms of their social conscience, but in terms of, I don't know, surplus cheese down the corner or whatever it may be.
I say that you're not interrupted by the events of the world, and you're actually... Well, I'll say on a roll. I don't know how you would describe it.
Oh,
if
yes,
you're writing.
There are exciting roles.
Is it something that you need? Does it just flow out of you? Do you need to rewrite? Do you work?
Oh, no, I rewrite extensively. A book of poetry like the Eats poems, for example, or All the Colors of the Race, I think they're 48 pages long or 64 pages. That's about the limit for a poetry book that's illustrated for younger kids or even for teenagers. Will be at least 6 months in the making, and sometimes longer, and then will take several years to find a publisher. And while that's happening, as the book gets turned down, sometimes not, sometimes they're sold right away. But when the process is a long one, because publishers publish so little poetry, even your own regular publishers, you do further revisions and you look for ways to tighten and to improve. And as you grow and change and mature, you go back to your older work, I think, like, not quite as extremely so, but in a way like Whitman revising Leaves of Grass until his death. You go back and you change and you bring the fresh insights to it. In terms of the first flush of the work of writing, day by day, a little bit every day in the same place, developing a natural kind of rhythm, internalizing, synthesizing the creative process so that it is utilitarian for you as a living artist, and all the way through the processes until it's utilitarian for the young person or adult who gets the book. The shortest poem in the Eats book, for example, is the one that went through literally 75 drafts. And since I work in my own study, I can tack up these drafts or put them up with masking tape all around me, and I find, and I'll use a little symbol like D1, D5, D10, that kind of thing, so I know the chronological order. But I find if I'm confronted by the work every morning as I walk into the room, it's not a matter of that element of will involved in opening up a file drawer or even pulling a file off a shelf. But there those things are, and I face them every day, and I can neglect them, but only for so long. And in the end, I will have to choose perhaps 5 or 6 of those 75 drafts, and in the end, I will have to choose the one draft which will be part of the manuscript. And that, of course, is a very difficult part of the creative process. Sometimes an early draft is the draft that will be, you know, you go too far, and the further you go, the more lost you become. And sometimes you can recognize that early on without that extra 2 or 3 weeks of work on a short poem. I write poetry of a complex nature that appears rather simple because it is for young people. But basically, I attempt to, if I could use a metaphor, I would say I'm the juggler. When I have all 6 Indian clubs or all 6 oranges up in the air at the same time, then I'm attempting to combine, even in the shortest poem for the youngest child, elements of poetic structure and poetic prose, elements of musicality or rhythmic nature, and semantic line of force or meaning or narrative, and elements of reality and fantasy. So these are 6 basic ingredients that go into the recipe of the poem, and it is not often that I can publish a book in which all 6 of those appear. But particularly the line between reality and fantasy is one that is drawn, I feel, rather harshly by the adults who control the world of publishing for children. Children, I feel, younger ones and even the more self-conscious teenagers do slide in and out of reality and fantasy far more quickly and easily and know the way back a lot more safely than do the adults who decide, well, this will be a book and it will be a fantasy book, and this will be a book and it will be a book of reality, and only one or the other.
You must choose.
Yes, it's unfortunate. Let me just say that the reason we're sitting here is that we're long overdue in sitting here, but also a wonderful thing has happened in that 3 of us in this little town in southwestern Ohio have joined forces to form our own record company. And so rather than just rage, we're attempting to light a candle here and there, maybe a bit of a corny candle or a chancy candle, but a jazz musician and record producer, Chuck Smart, affiliated here with YSO, and Chris Hertzler, who runs an absolutely superb state-of-the-art recording studio in Yellow Springs, and is a producer as well, and myself have joined forces. And these books and others have just been recorded with music, and they are being produced right now, even as we speak, and they'll be available on two cassettes. One of the more important books in these 8 that will be available on these first 2 cassettes is All the Colors of the Race. It's exciting to me that it's a young female who is a product of an interracial marriage. Her mother is black, her father is white. Some of the elements are autobiographical. Some of them are rip-offs from my daughter, as most authors do, if they will admit to you that they steal from their children when they write for that world of children. And some, of course, is fictionalization. All the Colors of the Race was an honor book in the Coretta Scott King Award this year, and I just found out yesterday it's been given a special citation by the Jane Addams Peace Committee for promoting peace and social justice, and that's great, because the catch line of All the Colors of the Race comes at the end of the book. All the colors of the race, human, of course, but I'll begin at the beginning. All the colors of the race are in my face and just behind my face, behind my eyes, inside my head, and inside my head I give myself a place at the end of a long line forming itself into a circle, and I am holding out my hands. I think the real color is behind the color, that skin on my face is for the cold mornings and the cool breezes of some summer afternoons. Under that skin and under that face is the real race. I have all these parts stuffed in me like Mama's chicken and biscuits and Daddy's apple pie and a tasty story from the family tree. But I know that tomorrow morning I'll wake up empty and hungry for that next bite of my new day. I cannot read you the whole book. Mama is black, and Daddy is white, and I am black, and I am white, besides my age and sex and clarinet. And then there are three flavors poems. Mama is chocolate. You must be swirls of dark fudge and ripples through your cocoa curls, chips and flips of sprinkles on your summer face. Daddy is vanilla. You must be mean old bean in the morning, cherry chunks by afternoon and sweet peach sometimes, but mostly you are vanilla up your arms. Me is better butter. I must be pecans, roasted, toasted, almond, walnut, three scoop combination cone, melting under kisses. It is a new color. It is a new flavor for love. It's fun. It's fun to do that. I just came back from a wonderful conference in Reno, Nevada that was sponsored by the University of Nevada, Reno, and a fine little college called Old College, which is a new college, naturally, which attempts to combine the humanities and pre-law studies. And the conference was called All the Colors of the Race, which was thrilling because it was named after the book, and it was an attempt to spotlight the variety of ethnic strains and parallel cultures in children's literature and in America as well. And it was exciting last Saturday night to read this whole book in front of a huge auditorium full of Chicano Americans and Chicano Americans from the Southwest and Japanese Americans who had survived the internment camps in the 1940s and the concentration camps, and Yarrington Indians living in a Paiute reservation in that area, and black Americans, and the choir, the youth choir of the Second Street Baptist Church of Reno, Nevada, and I don't know what you would say, white people from a variety of European backgrounds, if they go back in their families. And it was a lovely, lovely, truly American mixture for a truly American book. So I guess I'm still feeding off some of that energy. Particular poem has assured me of many luncheon engagements. I discover that reading specialists and English teachers and librarians all love this particular subject and are willing to have serious conversation and listen to a speech if they know at the end they're going to be rewarded with this kind of a dessert at one of their state conventions. And this is a very serious poem. And I know it's serious because I called it Love Song, love being the most serious of all subjects. Great goblets of pudding, powder in milk, hot with marshmallows on a winter afternoon, syrup on vanilla ice cream, frosting on cake, a kind of cake, a dripping to dry on warm donuts, fresh from the oven, candy, candy bars, bars, chunks, thick and broken pieces, squares, spoons and pots and lots before brushing, fudge and milk and German and sour cream, light and dark and bittersweet and even white. You are no good for me. You are no good. You are so good. Chocolate, chocolate, I love you so. I want to marry you and live forever in the flavor of your brown. And then everybody applauds and we go marching out and
of Hot Fudge Sundays.
All the way down the highway to Hershey, Pennsylvania or someplace. I don't know. It's a revolutionary poem.
That was a wonderful poem. I loved it.
Anyway, it's fun. And the sequel, when I'm finished doing the research to the Eats Poems book, will be called Chocolate Dreams, and all of the poems will deal with that one special subject because it's near and dear.
To a lot of people.
Anyway, to a lot of people, yes.
Well, let's become serious now.
All right.
You talked a little bit about, before we started this, and during the course of it, about the difficulty that any children's author has in getting his or her works published and actually put out there for an audience. And maybe you could personalize a little bit and tell me.
Well, Virginia and I were fortunate. We had the horses. We had worked hard. She went to Antioch. She went to Ohio State. I went to City College in Columbia. We spent many years in New York writing and studying and working with people. I worked with a superb Filipino-American poet named Jose Garcia Villa, who was a protege of Sitwell's. And we all have our influences. But by the 1960s, after the enduring the Civil Rights Movement, when things began to open up in America for non-mainstream groups because of agitation and activity, blacks becoming more visible, people talking about the white problem rather than the black problem, we were there and we were ready. And I had my anthologies, Virginia her novels, and the publishing industry was rolling and expanding. Federal entitlement money was coming in, editors were being hired, and over 3,000 individual titles were published every year by children's book publishers. Today, I would not want to be breaking in with poetry. I think Virginia Hamilton with a novel and some of the writers that do break in, particularly with prose, may have a little bit less of a problem. Or traditional verse for children. But you may be down to 2,000 children's book titles a year. Perhaps it's getting a little better in the last season. There are fewer publishing companies, however. There are fewer children's book divisions of major companies. There's been the little fish gobbled up by the big fish kind of thing. And sometimes that leads for efficiency. Sometimes it means that I can send one of my poetry manuscripts to one place, and that place is really three previous children's book departments. If fewer and fewer books are published for children every season, and there are basically two seasons of publishing, spring and fall, well, then there are fewer poetry books. There are fewer books of plays, of criticism, of text materials in the publishing field as well. A tremendous dampening effect which goes far beyond literature and poetry and people's unfamiliarity with poetry as part of their daily lives is something as unlikely as the Thor power tool decision, which happened a few years ago, and this present administration decided through the IRS that they would begin to enforce a decision that had been made earlier in the 1970s having to do with a power tool company. And what that meant would be that they would deal with publishers and with books, and through that mechanism, therefore, information and education and the real foundation of democracy in America, just as they deal with power tools. And so they would require that all books in warehouses would be considered in terms of face value, not at a tiny fraction, as they sit in warehouses. Well, this doesn't affect the publisher that puts out romances that sell 100,000 copies a month or the teenage varieties thereof. But in poetry, children and adults, and in criticism, and in work that may be innovative artistically or perhaps go counter to prevailing political or social attitudes, there is a tremendous reluctance on the part of publishers, whether they admit it or not, to publish this work. And they look much harder at something because they know it's going to cost them more money, because slow-selling, but even though steady-selling books are going to be a tremendous burden and a drain and will show up in red, perhaps, in terms of the bottom line of the computer printout sheet for the accountants to look at. It's that kind of situation. It's meant that many, many books have gone out of print long before that time. Publishers cannot go back and do small printings. And it's been a chilling effect in American intellectual life, and one that has been talked about in the American Library Association. There have been demonstrations by authors tearing up copies of their books on library steps and whatnot in protest. Disclaimers by publishers that they're not really remaindering books the way they are told, said to be, or even putting them back into the acid vats and melting them down for pulp or whatever. But there are committees working, the Authors Guild, others are involved in this. There's legislation in Congress to change it. This is an important factor. Many times you begin with poetry and end in politics or economics. There are other factors as well. It's a tough time.
Is the fact that, say, we'll just take children's poetry since, you know, that's the subject at hand, is it that nobody's interested in
it? There's a tremendous interest. It's just that there's a limit to the number of books that a publishing company can do and do well every season. And it is a prose-oriented society, a story-oriented society, and there are authors who are published, who are established, who are products that sell season after season, and they must be taken care of, and their fans or their clientele, the librarians, the reading specialists, whatever, must be serviced. And then, of course, there are smaller numbers of people who appreciate poetry. But all young people at one time or another read poetry, study poetry, write poetry. And so far, the way the system has worked out, a small, steady stream of poetry in each generation has been sufficient. Who is there to organize an outcry for more? It would be a highly revolutionary kind of thing, and I don't look for that. I am satisfied with the numbers of books that I publish. My publishers are the ones who are committed to poetry and are committed to waiting longer for positive cash flow and getting those books out little by little and sending me to conventions and doing all of that promotional kind of work. But they are limited in the numbers of my books that they can publish. And so I have to look for other publishers with other commitments. And not all publishers have commitments. Some publishers claim, I cannot sell poetry. We do not know how to sell them. Some publishers have another kind of situation. They acquire titles by joint committee, and on the committees will sit sales managers as well as the creative people, editorial people. And many times these are the people that will upset the balance in terms of material that brings in positive cash flow. The wonderful thing about children's literature is that 80-85% of children's books are sold to schools and libraries and school libraries. And so traditionally, and still true today by and large, a person can write the very finest literature, like Virginia Hamilton, the very finest poetry, like Arnold Adolf, the most superb illustrations, like a Sendak or the Dillons, or a 600-poem anthology of black poetry that I did years ago that is still in print that no adult department would do. Because these books don't compete for profit margin per square foot of bookstore floor space, a black writer does not have to be self-exploitive and have a lynch scene or a hot little Mandingo plantation number. You can do some extraordinary things, and this isn't just in racial terms, but all across the board. Some of the finest writing in all forms is being done for children through children's literature. Unfortunately, there are limits in terms of what can go out, and poetry has always been in the back of the bus in this country.
Across all age groups.
Across all age groups, yes. Yeah. We're thrilled with the people who we work with and who are really getting children's books into the hands of children, and my poetry particularly is 100-fold, 1,000-fold more used and published in any way you want to look at it than if I were writing strictly for my peers. But cumulatively, in a country of 220 million Americans, the latest, if I'm correct, the latest Publishers Weekly poll we saw, I think, had something like only 3% of the American population ever goes into a bookstore. And out of that 3%, only 1% of that 3% ever goes to the back to look at the children's books. So there again, television, radio, these are still the sources.
It's real interesting also because of those books, I would imagine, they, as you were saying, it is a prose-oriented society, a story-oriented society. And a question that comes to my mind is sort of, why, if you had to convince somebody, not no arm twisting, but convince somebody to actually pick up a book of poetry as opposed to a children's story book, I mean, what would you tell them? What arguments would you present to them?
Well, my arguments are in the first line of the first of the first piece. As with any kind of writing for any age, you've got to grab the reader and hold the reader, and I use the term inevitability, but that's the process of writing has to create the lines that begin and follow and middle and end that follow through so that you cannot stop, because you must know what's going on, whether that's semantically, or you must continue to go on because you're involved in a flow, some kind of a vortex, a movement that you cannot get out of. That's a difficult thing to explain to you or even to myself back again as the artist talking to the artist. It's impossible to do that with a reader or a young reader. What most people do is talk about subject matter, which I think is a very narrow approach, but one which again goes back to story. And so we talk about the girl running track, and we talk about the birds, and we talk about food and the kid playing baseball or whatever it is. You talk about what it is, who are these characters, what are they doing. But there's so much more to poetry than that. Otherwise, it would be prose. When I studied with Jose at the New School back in the 60s, I remember we spent 17 one-hour sessions on only the differences between poetry and prose, which just took up a large suitcase full of notes that I carry around. I never open them again. I don't dare, but it's kind of like, some comforting thing that, is there. Well, this is far beyond the way most Americans, even critics, even the finest practitioners of adult poetry really view poetry.
It's just really interesting to me because in the series, in this context of the series on contemporary poetry, it's been real fascinating. We come into this room covered with burlap on the walls, and people sit and read their poetry to me, and I find that right now. Okay. Well, I just find that it sort of transforms my day. I walk out of the studio.
Well, it would be wonderful, seriously, if everybody could encounter a poem every day. If whatever you picked up, not that you had to go to the library or a bookstore. Of course, it would be wonderful if you just go across the street and sit on the carpet at the children's section, or say to the librarian, "What's new this week?" and sit on there with the kids and read. But most people just don't have that luxury in the time of their life. But if they turn on the TV sets or pick up the daily newspaper and it was a poem, not just a little inspirational verse, but if it was, if it was really a part of our lives, but it's not. And so it isn't anymore the teacher who spoiled it for us with the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner. It really is that it's not a natural part of life. We don't encounter it. And there are reasons. There are political reasons. Poets have always been on the cutting edge of change. Poets who delve politically, who attempt to stir emotions. Poets are put in labor camps in countries, are called insane, are crucified in a variety of ways. Perhaps in America, in this functioning democracy, we do it benignly, just by making it so difficult to publish their work or just to speak to each other, perhaps, in small journals, that kind of thing. I think it's wonderful when you can produce work that speaks to large audiences and that has substance as well as art, and one kind of compromise or another does not have to be made to get that large audience. And in children's literature, that's true. It's not a vast audience or a mass audience. Another thing I might say is none of my books, my anthologies, yes, because of school use, but none of my own books of poetry are in paperback, and I do not see them going into paperback in the foreseeable future. That's the difference between large audience and mass that we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
The Eats book was turned down by all the paperback houses in New York, and it's a monster bestseller in the hardcover edition, and it will always sell wonderfully well. But thousands of copies don't mean anything to hundreds of thousands, which is the way paperback houses look
at the mass market.
The reality, yes, and that's another aspect of the society.
Well, we're talking also about pricing poetry out of. That we can get into another political topic.
Smaller editions, even just the practical business aspects. The smaller editions mean higher prices. It's more expensive to set poetry. The paper's more expensive. The ink, illustrations, all those things make you want a beautiful book. The book is the environment of the page is the environment of the poem.
Mm-hmm.
But, it's a fascinating thing. We could spend hours, and I do many times when I do college workshops, and you could call something, everything you always wanted to know about poetry but didn't really ever want to know. Or about poetry, or much more than you could ever. Poets, as other specialists, will go on and on and on. You want to know if you're going to have an operation that the surgeon will give you terrific odds, but you don't really want to get into the technical aspects of what he's going to do beyond the general understanding. But he will go on for hours because he's so thrilled with the way he can handle that little laser number now. That's the way I feel about flushing to the right, or flushing to the left, or the proportional spacing, or the balancing, or those kinds of things.
Well, I can imagine that. It's something that you've created.
And poets have a mystique. I like to talk about those elements of poetics, because most of the time poets are looked at as either holy men, or unholy holy men, or bizarre freaks, or alcoholics, or druggies, or suicides, or gay blades of a variety of genders running around. And that's a sad thing. Not all poets are middle class and middle aged, but I think all poets are human beings, and as human as perhaps three-piece suited college professors or novelists or what have you. Many times I think these mistakes develop because poets, as with musicians or any other groups that are on the fringes of mainstream society, have nothing else but mystique. And so it's wonderful to do your Dylan Thomas number as you run around America, because you're running around America for a couple of cents here and there that is not the reason the best-selling novelist runs around America. However, that separates your art from people. And I've always been concerned with the utilitarian aspect of the art. And so if the book is I Am the Running Girl, and that girl trains, and those training instructions included in those complex poems have to be as precise as the simplest prose training instructions that you can pick up in a Xerox sheet from the coach's office at the high school, that kind of thing. And mm-hmm. in the Eats poems, there are five of my recipes. And obviously I use those recipes, and they work well, and they have to work well, even though they're in the form of an element of poetic prose. Anyway, I think that's something that we have not had in America, the use of this particular art. We are a use-oriented society, and I think I'm a product of that as well, the 1930s and 40s. But I think we can use poetry the way we use everything else in this country. There are certainly enough poets so that we won't get used up, that's for sure. Many of the books that I do deal with black and white kind of family situations, but it's the kisses and the hugs that are the universality of all of our experiences and are the important parts of the books. And so a book like Black is Brown is Tan, which was the first book, poetry or prose, really to deal with an interracial family in literature for children, is used by the vast and various combinations of peoples that we have in America, which is exciting and wonderful and sad as well, because there should be one with a black father and a white mother, and one with the Chinese and Korean and Vietnamese and Cambodian and Southern Appalachian and Northwest American Indian mixtures that we find any and everywhere around America. Of course, it's enabled me to encounter many of these people as they come up and see me when we meet and talk. But I would hope that the adults in the audience and the adults who work with the children and the children would take some of our books and say, I can do it different, I can do it better, and use them as foundation stones and go on and do their own writing from their own experiences. Black is brown, is tan, is girl, is boy, is nose, is face, is all the colors of the race, is dark, is light, singing songs in singing night, kiss big woman, hug big man, black, is brown, is tan, this is the way it is for us, this is the way we are. I am mom and mommy, mama, mamu, meanie, ma, and mom again with mighty hugs and hairbrush mornings catching curls. Later we sit by the window and your head is up against my chest. We read and tickle and sing the words into the air. Go out to cut wood for the fire or cook the corn and chicken legs. And you say you're getting bigger than me and you say, chocolate, mama, chocolate up the milk, and I say, drink the milk, and laugh out loud. I am black, I am brown, the milk is chocolate brown, I am the color of the milk, chocolate cheeks and hands that darken in the summer sun, a nose that peels brown skin in August. I am black, I am a brown sugar gown, a tasty tan and coffee pumpkin pie with dark brown eyes and almond ears, and my face gets ginger red when I puff and yell you into bed. This is the way it is for us. This is the way we are. I am dad, am daddy, ding bat da, and kiss me pa with the big belly and the loud voice, sitting at my desk and you sit on my lap. We read and laugh and pinch the words into the air. Go out to cut wood for the fire or cook the corn and hamburgers, and both the parents do the firewood cutting and the cooking. And you say you're getting bigger than me when I say drink the milk. I am white. The milk is white. I am not the color of the milk. I am white. The snow is white. I am not the color of the snow. I am white. I am white. I am light. With pinks and tiny tans, dark hair growing on my arms that darken in the summer sun, brown eyes, big yellow ears, and my face gets tomato red when I puff and yell you into bed. This is the way it is for us. This is the way we are. Daddy's sister Florence with the gold, gold hair, and Mama's tan man brother who plays the frying pan. There is Granny White and Grandma Black, kissing both your cheeks and hugging back, sitting by the window, telling stories of a go, and you say you're getting bigger than all of them and pour a glass of milk for every one. Black is brown, is tan, is girl, is boy, is nose, is face, is all the colors of the race, is dark, is light, singing songs and singing night, kiss big woman, hug big man, black is brown, is tan.
Poet and anthologist Arnold Adolf. His work is now being put onto cassette by Earworks, Post Office Box 293, Yellow Springs, Ohio 45387. This program was produced by Marcy Silman at WYSO. Thank you.